Welcome to the show that is always up to speed with Formula One. This is the, and I always mispronounce it, and I'm super, super embarrassed because of it, but the Scuderia F1 podcast. Like I said, the podcast that is always up to speed with F1, but not, as a number of our eagle-eyed listeners detected, not up to speed with IndyCar when last week I said Kevin Magnussen won the Grand Prix of Detroit on Saturday when, of course, it was Formula or former F1 driver Marcus Ericsson. Although conveniently, and thank you to our good listener Michelle G for calling this out, Kevin Magnussen ended up at least with a part-time IndyCar ride this week. So maybe inadvertently predicted that, but we're a couple of days away from the French Grand Prix. Free practice kicks off tomorrow. Tons to talk about, not least of which is the entire tire gate, which has spilled over from Baku. That story does not seem to be ready to pop anytime soon. My friend, how are you?
I'm good, man. It is Thursday, almost Friday. I'm ready to get my weekend on. I was grilling outside this evening. It was a beautiful day here in Vancouver. Warm, not hot, just extremely pleasant, bit of a breeze. I'm feeling it. I'm totally ready for summer. I mean, we haven't had very much summer weather just yet. You know, June could be wet around here, but the last couple of days been beautiful, and I'm ready to get summer going 100%. So,
you made a great point too that it sounds like your kids get to see their grandparents again for the first time in a while. I didn't mention this, but we're going to see my parents on Sunday, and I think it's probably been about 9 months since. So, I've got a little one as well, a 3.5-year-old. So, I think it'll be the first time that he's seen them since maybe last summer. So, it's been forever. And I think in your case, again, it's been forever since the kids have been able to interact with their grandparents, so they must be super excited.
Oh, totally. You know, I've been making this joke ever since the start of the pandemic and all the social distancing and stuff like that. For some relationships that we have, it means far less social contact. For some of us, about the same as usual. You know, the people that you see once every year or year and a half or 2 years, that never changed. But, you know, it is, you know, all joking aside, is it exciting to see everything kind of starting to go back to normal? It's great to turn on the TV and see sporting events and people out in public and people doing things again. I'm starting to feel good. And I'm glad to see that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. But like you said, the one thing that I can't get out of my mind this week is just the fact that this whole Tiregate thing just won't go away. It's the story that just will not refuse to die. You know, we'll talk about in a moment, because there was a couple of things I wanted to get to first, that if, you know, we get into it, it's going to be kind of like buried a little bit further down. So, couple of weeks still until the British Grand Prix at Silverstone in the United Kingdom, of course. And so apparently that in the UK, they're going to delay the end of the lockdown and the sort of the return to normal by another 4 weeks or a month. And pardon me, the July 19th is when they get back to normal. That's not necessarily the day of the race, but it, you know, there was some talk at one point to basically fill Silverstone. So this may or may not happen. So outdoor events at the moment in the UK, and I didn't know this until I did a little bit of reading about it, is 10,000 people or 25% of the venue's capacity. So whichever is the lower number. So it is, we'll have to wait and see what happens, because I mean, there's obviously people in the stands for the Euros, you know, if you've been watching a lot of soccer, which I've been doing for the last almost a week now. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I kind of think about it, you know, as like, I sometimes feel a little bit uncomfortable now. And I think it's just a psychological thing, having lived through the whole pandemic the past year and a half. It feels a bit weird to see people and stuff like that. But when you see like Indy, you go and turn on, you see like a baseball game, you see the stands filled and stuff like that, that, you know, maybe I need just to chill out a little bit. But however, if they get it going and they get people in there, I hope that they do get the maximum amount of people into the stands at Silverstone on July 18th, because it's such a great race. It's such a great atmosphere. And you know that the home support is just going to power Lewis. He's going to give him an extra 50 horsepower at least. And it's always it's always a great event. So I'm just hoping that it
seems to work because he tends to win there every single year, it would seem. But I agree. I was really, really, really excited. And I think obviously the 140,000 people that have bought tickets for that Sunday race could be equally as disappointed if there could be some cap or restriction on the numbers. I have a sneaking suspicion that given the uniqueness of the event and what it means to British tourism as really a tentpole flagship event for the sport and for for sports in the UK as well. I have a feeling that they're going to find a way to make this work. This is really different than sticking 80,000 people in the confines of an outdoor football bowl. This is 140,000 people that are spread around a 6 mile or 6 kilometer track. I've walked around Silverstone. It takes 2 hours. It's a long walk. My wife is angry every time I make her do it, and I've done it twice. And it's so funny because every time I promise it'll be shorter than last time. And of course it isn't, but it's a big track, right? Like I think from a population density perspective, if you're willing to put 10,000 people in a grandstand or 22,000 people in a football stadium for one of the Euro 2022 matches or Euro 20 matches, I guess, if you're willing to put 22,000 to 40,000 people in a bowl, you can spread 140,000 people out over 6 kilometers. I think they're going to find a way. Maybe they do some things in terms of entry exit to get creative, to make sure you don't have big lines and things like that. I have a feeling they're going to be at 140, if not very, very close. I think this event means so much to the country. And I think from the government's perspective, I think they'd always targeted this as that inflection moment where it changes from we're in a strict COVID mentality to things are getting back to normal. And I think it's important for everyone, not least of which are the fans that have bought tickets to go. And I've been to Silverstone so many times. It's such a magical place in terms of atmosphere. I'm looking forward to it. I hope they do it. And I have a feeling they probably will.
Well, for the sake of one day, I mean, if the current restrictions lift on July 19th and the race is scheduled to go on July 18th, you would think that hopefully they can find some sort of solution to make it happen, because it would be a real shame if they couldn't. I mean, of course, safety is paramount, but things, we're a far different place than we were even 4 or 5 months ago. So I certainly hope that that they can make it work. All right. The next one I wanted to talk about, and this one, we didn't talk about it immediately after the race. I know we talked about it on the weekly show, and this was the whole Mick Schumacher, Nikita Mazepin incident at the end of the race in Baku there a couple of weeks ago, when Mick went to go and pass his teammate down the start-finish straightaway there. He gets alongside, and Nikita makes that really naughty flick to the right and really got Mick Schumacher upset about it. They said after the race that they cleared the air, but the thing that really kind of caught me off guard was just the way that that Mazepin is kind of really downplaying it now. And basically, you got to read the whole quote here, but it is kind of interesting, because basically what he is saying is that he feels that Mick cannot expect to have it too easy in Formula One. Okay, fair enough. But there is a difference about, okay, having people making your life too easy and letting them pass you easier than you should probably make it for them. Then when you're going over 200 miles an hour down one of the fastest sections of track anywhere we see in the entire year, and then when your teammate comes alongside you, then you decide to make your one entitled defensive maneuver and flick your car to the right. So, you know, fine, you know, you're entitled, you're permitted to defend your position, but just not when your teammate's along beside you or any one of the other 19 cars. I thought was a bit of a silly comment, to say the least. Well, I'm pretty sure you're going to say the same thing. I think you're going to agree with me on this one. I'm hoping you will.
Yeah, I just think at this point, people have failed to recognize the genius that is Mazepin's racecraft. And hopefully the rest of the F1 community gets there and we can start to put some respect on his name. In all seriousness, though, I totally agree. It was a dangerous maneuver, not least of which is because Schumacher had a toe, and the minute you step out of that toe, it's very, very, very hard to react if he's going to cut in front of you, and you need to understand that. But furthermore, he's a teammate, and if he has the toe and he has the pace, let him go. You're not competing for points. Like, this is just a pride issue. Ultimately, I would have let him go. It was a dangerous maneuver. And ultimately, if Mazepin had moved in front of him, had completed his block, ultimately, you're going to end up in one of two places. You're going to end up in the back of Mazepin, which is going to destroy both of your race, or you're going to end in the wall. And maybe you collect him and take him with you. I can't wrap my head around this. And I saw as well, just the comments that Mazepin made about, I made an apology, but I didn't apologize. It was that apologies, I'm sorry that you're upset, not I'm sorry for a dangerous move, because Mazepin's genuinely of the mindset that he wasn't at fault here. That, hey, I thought you were going to go one way, not the other. Sorry you're upset. Move on. And Gunther Steiner, obviously, he indicated that this wasn't something they were going to talk about in public. Mazepin refuses to elaborate, but I'm over it. I think it's just a reflection of what we see and what we know of Mazepin. And like I said, when we talked about this last time, we're just incredibly lucky that one of these incidents, either as a backmarker blocking a front-running car or a dangerous maneuver in qualifying or free practice, we're just lucky that he hasn't yet collected another car. And we joke, Mazepin. Obviously, there's a number of spinning issues at the beginning of the season as he was starting to come to grips with the tires. But ultimately, we're just lucky that he hasn't collected another car. And created a really dangerous scenario for other people. And again, this is the risk of having somebody that isn't the caliber of other people that could potentially be in Formula One, whether it's Nick De Vries or Hulkenberg or Albon, or you could Magnussen or Ericsson or any of those other drivers. But yeah, I'm a little bit frustrated.
Yeah, I can tell. Well, you know, one of the other drivers that Sergio Perez was showing a little bit of love to was Ward. I mean, he's been doing phenomenal in IndyCar this year. And I guess he's showing a little bit of love to his fellow countrymen. So it's kind of interesting. You know, we keep talking about when is the sport going to start building in North America? I mean, we have three North American drivers right now. You know, it'd be interesting to see if a Ward could make it in. That would make a second Mexican driver. And I mean, the one question we get a lot from our listeners is when are we going to see an American driver in F1? We talked about it on Monday night, but interesting. Anyways, let's start off the conversation here. We're a couple of minutes away from the first break, but this one is, like you mentioned in the intro there, Mark, it is just not going away. And this is what we've started to dub Tiregate. And this goes back to those two massive punctures and they weren't even punctures. They were explosions.
Totally.
That Lance Stroll and Max Verstappen had at the Azerbaijan Grand Prix a couple of weeks ago. And it's interesting because if you read the press release that that Pirelli put out there just earlier this week, it's kind of interestingly worded, right? It's like they kind of point the finger at the teams, but they don't out and out really blame them for running with lower tire pressures, and that's basically what they were saying. So Aston Martin and Red Bull were the two teams that were involved. Pirelli confirmed that they had followed the regulations with the minimum starting tire pressures and the minimum tire warmer temperatures. Those are those, for those of you who knew the sport, those heated blankets that you see them pulling off the tires in the garage before they take the tires out for the pit stop. So, you know, they're not quite up to race temperature, but they're about as hot and as warm as they can get to them. Anyways, so Pirelli says that they set their basic starting tire pressure based on the expectation, well, the tire pressure will raise once that the tires are out on the track, they're up to temperature, and all those sorts of other variables that they take into consideration. So what they were saying is that it appears that on the Aston Martin and the Red Bull, they didn't actually experience that raise in pressure and were actually running at a lower tire pressure than Pirelli indicated, or where they were anticipating and expecting the tires to run at. So it it's the first domino in a whole bunch of different events that basically caused the whole tire to fail. But the thing that I find amazing is that the tires failed at almost an identical place on the track with almost a similar sort of a number of laps on them. So it is very, very interesting. So they talk about this thing about the standing waves, which is some sort of phenomena that goes through the tires, goes through the rubber, as the tires are going to experience all these different forces as the car is going around the track and as the tires age and everything like that. And it says that because of these high-speed corners at Baku, that was enough to really, really set off the whole collapse of the tire that basically exploded the left rear tire on both of those cars. It's very interesting. I mean, it really gets into an area of tires that I really had no idea really existed. I mean, why should we? I mean, we obviously follow the sport closely, but this is really getting to some nitty gritty and some of the real depths of tire construction, design, and everything that goes into it. It's really fascinating.
It's totally fascinating. And it's not the first time we've had this conversation in the V6 hybrid era. Like, this was a big scandal in 2016. And I remember the FIA and Pirelli had to change their protocols for testing tire pressure going into, I think it was Austria. And the teams had some funny shenanigans back then. So really, I think it comes down to this, which is Pirelli constructs the tires and they provide advice and recommendations to the teams based on optimal operating conditions. So they say, hey, the tire pressure needs to be at this for this tire on this track in these conditions at this temperature. Now the teams always prefer to run a lower pressure. And the reason the teams want to run a lower pressure is that even though it creates more rolling resistance in the tire, which could conceivably mean the car's a little bit slower, by having less pressure, you create more contact patch. So with less pressure, there's physically more tire touching the road, which in theory means you get more grip. The consequence of this is exactly what you just described, which is if the temperature's too low, it triggers this phenomenon called standing waves, which is basically a ripple in the sidewall of the tires. And that compromises the construction of the tires. And eventually the sidewalls could effectively just tear themselves apart and the tires can come apart, which is, I think, potentially what happened here. So Pirelli does their investigation and they come back and say, there's nothing wrong with the tires, but they're also not specifically pointing the finger at the teams. The teams are saying, hey, we were running the tires to the conditions and the parameters that you advised us to do. But at the same time, the teams aren't sharing up the telemetry. So the teams have real-time on-demand data showing what the tire temperature is at any given minute on the track. Now, mm-hmm. The way that the teams presumably circumvent this is they will test test the tire pressure. So the FIA, Formula One, Pirelli, they come around and test the tire temperature. But I think what they've been trying to do historically is use tire blankets to conceal the true tire pressure, because as a tire gets hot, the tire pressure heats up. So for instance, if you're ever at home and you go and check the pressure of the tire on your car, like it looks a little bit flat. Okay, it's 26 PSI. It's supposed to be at 32. If you then drive a couple of miles to the gas station and check the tire pressure again, it'll have raised. So what we think, or what people think these teams are doing, is that the tire pressure is actually lower when it's being tested than it's supposed to be, but that's being concealed because they're effectively heating up the tire. So when they do test it, it looks higher than it actually is because it's already benefited from that increase in heated temperature. And if you go back to 2016, it was highly speculated that teams were being so sneaky that some of them had actual heating elements built into the wheels themselves to heat up the tires for this purpose. So it's totally crazy. Now, all of this said, I don't know whether I necessarily sympathize with the teams or I sympathize with Pirelli, but what I will say is that Pirelli's in a really difficult position, right? Ultimately, there's not going to be a lot of glamour associated with F1. The only time people are ever going to mention your tires is when something goes wrong. And I think what you have to consider here is a couple of things. They are asked to develop a tire that can be safely used on the most powerful racing cars on the planet every season, when the standards and the formula of the cars change every single season. So never have the cars had more downforce, never have they been faster, but every single year, F1 is totally reinventing the formula of what an F1 car is, whether it's through power, downforce, grip, width. So every single season, Pirelli's got to go and reinvent these tires. They have to do it as well without the ability to test. Pirelli doesn't have a factory with their own Formula One cars. They can't throw some tires on a car and head out to a track during the winter to test. They have to rely on the teams. Now, that said, the teams should be able to provide some data, but ultimately it wouldn't be as much as if they had their own testing cars. And then I think finally, the only other real consideration that I have is when it comes to this conversation, the tires have artificial limits. And by that, I mean the FIA and Formula One have gone to Pirelli and basically said, we need you to create a tire whose grip level and performance is going to destroy, like just fall off a cliff at a certain point. So when we talk about tire degradation and all of those things, we're not pushing the limits of engineering when it comes to tires. Like the durability and the longevity of the grip in these tires is totally artificial because Formula One wants a spectacle and they want to have that mandatory pit stop every race. Pirelli is being given some really difficult constraints here. Develop a new tire every year based on the formula of the car, and also develop a tire that has a compound that's going to fall off after a set amount of laps. Like, they're in a really difficult position, and I don't want to oversympathize and be considered a Pirelli homer, but I just want to state that for all the criticism of Pirelli, their job is a very difficult one.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a couple of thoughts on that, and I'm going to address them right after we take our first break, so don't go away. We're going to be right back. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Okay, well, welcome back to the show. Mark and Mark here talking about all the latest news in Formula One. And just before the break there, we were talking about what we've been calling affectionately Tiregate. And this is the whole saga that's just won't go away. The exploding tires we saw from Max Verstappen and Lance Stroll at the Azerbaijan a couple of weeks ago. We were just talking about in the previous segment about how Pirelli released their report earlier this week. And it is interesting. I mean, you made a couple of great points. I mean, specifically, Pirelli don't have a test facility or cars that they their own cars that they can go and test these new compounds with. And that's typically why we see a tire testing day at the end of the year, which they've done for the past several years. And some of the drivers and teams will take part. And now, one of the things that have come out subsequently to the report is that the FIA have actually sent out a technical directive saying that the teams have to be responsible to make sure that they're running the tire pressures that are above those that are stipulated by Pirelli in advance of the race. So basically, the FIA has said you have to be at these minimum tire pressures, and so that any team that are found to be running tires that are found after the race to be under the pressures that were dictated and set up by Pirelli are actually going to be reported to the stewards. Because as we've seen, it's not like a competitive advantage thing. Maybe it is, but that's not the main concern here. It's a safety issue. And we talked about it in the post-race show we did on that Sunday night, that both Max and Lance were extremely fortunate that where they had their tire incidents was on the fastest part of the track, and neither of them ended up getting airborne or rolling over or any other number of really, really scary things. So it is, I think that they have to do it. But you know what's also interesting, right, is this whole tire thing was completely unexpected. But starting this weekend, we're going to have two new enforcements come to play. One is the tire thing, and then the other thing is this crackdown on the flexi wings that's been out there for, you know, more than several weeks now. So these are both going to come into effect this week. But what do you think? I think it's a great idea that they've laid down this technical directive. And yeah, if you're not running at those minimum cold tire temperatures, you should be brought to the attention of the stewards. Basically, like I say, safety issue, and that's got to be paramount to number one.
Yeah, I thought we'd solve this back in 2016. Clearly, we hadn't. Hopefully, there's some better clarification and protocols established around when and where tire temperatures are tested. Like it almost needs to be on the formation lap or immediately before they hit the formation lap. But then that doesn't work because you've just taken the wheels out of the tire blankets. Or maybe it's ultimately that Pirelli holds onto the wheels and tires. They test them all, and then they'll figure it out. They've got to figure it out, because to your point, this is ultimately a health and safety issue. The other risk, and I'd seen a few folks on Reddit comment that ultimately, if Pirelli's in a really difficult position here, you know what they're going to do, right? Is they're going to upset teams, because they're just going to start bringing harder compound tires to races when in the past, maybe they would have brought a softer compound tire, because they want to be conservative, because they want to be safe. And the other thing that they're going to start doing is just starting recommending higher pressures. So, hey, you've got to look out for Pirelli here. We need to look out for the safety of the sport. If you guys are going to tamper with tire pressure to get more grip, despite the addition of additional rolling resistance, we're just going to bring harder compounds. and we're going to recommend higher pressure. So even if you try to circumvent it, it's still in a safe range. So I'll be very curious to see how this plays. The other piece, and kudos to a number of our listeners that sent us this story, but there was a story earlier this week that indicated that when Sergio came over to Red Bull from Aston Martin, one of the stories that he shared with them was Aston Martin's strategy around tire pressures and how they manage tire pressures. Okay. And if you remember, last year in the rain, the Aston Martin team in Turkey did exceptionally well, qualifying on pole and in third place. And of course, the race result ended up in a second and a ninth because, of course, Lance had that unfortunate front wing damage. But ultimately, the story basically inferred that the reason they were so successful in qualifying at that event was simply because they were manipulating the tire pressures. And not surprisingly then, if Sergio brought that feedback and experience from Aston Martin over to Red Bull, and Red Bull maybe implemented that feedback, look at the two teams. And again, this is purely speculative. Like, there's no actual hardcore reporting here, but you look at the outcome of the race. It was an Aston Martin and it was a Red Bull. So maybe it is these two teams, but yeah, it's just, I go back to the announcement. It was a non-announcement. We investigated, the tires were fine. And based on what we can see, the teams weren't at fault. End of story.
Yeah, I know, right? I've got a couple of quotes that I want to read out to you in a moment. But one thing that, if you don't really notice it so much in your road car, unless your tires really suffer a real drop in tire pressure. But the one thing that I notice, and I'm an avid cyclist, I'm out all the time. And the tires on my road bike, I think they're rated anywhere from, I can't remember if it's 100 to 120 PSI or 110 to 120. So what I tend to do is if it's a wetter weather, or the roads are a bit wet and it might not be raining, I'll set the tire pressure on the lower end, closer to 100 PSI or 110 or whatever it is. Or if the roads are drier, I'll put the pressure closer to 120. And you notice a difference. I mean, you can see it on the tire. You can see that when you're on the bike, you can see that there is a bigger contact patch. And this is on a 700 by 23 millimeter tire. So, I mean, it's not a Formula One tire by a long stretch. But you can see that the tire does make more contact, even on a skinny bike tire like that. But also, when it is on the harder, the higher tire pressure, you notice a difference too. So
totally.
You do know, yeah, it is noticeable. And of course, if you're driving around in your road car at 10 PSI, you're not going to have a good day. Anyways. Totally.
And I don't know if anyone here watches Top Gear, but back in, I think, 2007, when they went to the North Pole, so I'm inferring everyone knows who Top Gear is, or the cast, but they took a Toyota pickup truck, a Hilux, I think, to the North Pole from one of the Northern Canadian territories. And one of the ways that they would get through heavy, heavy, heavy snow, or if they get stuck, they would simply deflate the tires. So the tires would be flat, but you get this huge contact patch. So you had that much more grip to pull you out of the snow. And it's effectively oversimplifying it for sure. That's really kind of the situation that we've experienced here. And Pirelli's ultimately just saying, like, hey, we give you an operating range for tire pressure. And if you go below it, you do it at your own risk. But ultimately, it looks like Pirelli and the FIA and Formula One are going to have to start enforcing this for the safety of the cars and the drivers.
Okay, yeah, absolutely, 100%. Okay, two quotes from our championship protagonist, Lewis Hamilton. Quote, as you know, every weekend, whenever there's a failure, they always put the pressures up, so that tells you something. More often than not, it's that the tires are not being run at the pressures that are being asked. We didn't have a problem with our tires. I think that they've done a great job with the tires this year. They're more robust than before, and I think in this particular instance, I don't think Pirelli are at fault. At the end of the day, safety is always the priority. And for me, my team, there have been clear rules and guidelines as to where we have to operate. End quote. Okay, Lewis Hamilton. Now, Max Verstappen on the other hand. So Max says, quote, of course, they explained that they don't have the measurement tools during the race, but we gave them our tire pressures and they were within the limits they set. If those limits are not correct, then there's nothing we can do about it. We just follow what is possible within the rules. If that means we have to go up on the pressures, we will. Everyone will go up on the pressures. But they didn't say that they didn't have the correct measurements, but we gave it to them after the race and it was shown that we didn't do anything wrong there. And also Aston Martin to do anything wrong, so they cannot put the blame on us. I think they need to look at themselves. And we are here, happy to help, of course, with everything. They already went up on pressure from Friday in Baku to Saturday, so that means something. Maybe it wasn't enough. We'll go up on pressures here for sure, and hopefully that's enough. End quote. So, interesting,
I love that he's speaking on behalf of Aston Martin.
I know, right? Oh, that's so part funny. Of it. But it's funny, you know, it seems that not only are they adversaries in the car, but they seem to be adversaries also out of the car. Whenever one of them makes a quote and it's sort of read back to them or relayed to them through the media, it always seems to be that the other one will take the counter position to it. I thought it was interesting the way that Lewis put it, that they hadn't seen any or they hadn't any issues. They have clear procedures during the team. Whereas Max was kind of like, well, you know, we just did what Pirelli gave us, and it wasn't good enough. Same with Aston Martin. We gave everything back to them, and hopefully, you know, it's okay. It seems very much that the vibe I get from Lewis is, okay, we get the data from Pirelli, but then we've got our own thing that we do. And it seems, just sort of reading between the lines there, that Mercedes has their own procedures about it, whereas Max kind of, the way that he kind of explained it is, okay, we just get the stuff from Pirelli and we just do whatever they say, and then that's it. I can't believe it would be as simple and cut and dry as that Mercedes... They have their own sort of set protocols around tire pressures, and Red Bull basically washed their hand. It's like, Pirelli told us to do this, so we're going to do this. I can't believe it's that simple, Mark.
Yeah, I totally agree. Just a couple of points too. A lot of our listeners had kind of reached out and said, well, why don't we just change the tire provider if this is such a problem? Tires have always been an issue. There's never been a period in F1 history where everyone is content with the tires. The reality too is, and we talked about this, I just don't think there's another manufacturer lining up to take on this contract. I think we're lucky we have Pirelli. They're clearly invested. I wish they had more ability to do off-season testing, but I don't think there's anyone lining up. The other consideration too is originally when they signed this deal in 2018, it was through 2023. It was extended a year, I think partly because of COVID, but also because of the regulation delays. So they're going to be around for a couple more years, but I just don't see anyone else coming in. And if somebody else did come in, like, you got to think about it. Pirelli's not going to hand them the IP on the tires they've been developing. Like, they start from scratch.
Yep.
You have to build a new factory and hire an R&D team. So there's a sunk cost that would probably run in the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. And then what's our ROI on this? Like, nobody else is coming in. The other thing too is, while we've had periods in the past where there have been multiple tire suppliers, we will never see that again. I promise you, we will never see that again. If the 2005 USGP taught us anything, there's too much risk to the integrity of the sport. The other challenge too is, I would hate to see a situation where you had Team A and Team B, and they're going right down to the final, and ultimately one of the teams has a bad tire, or they made a bad tire. She's like, I'd hate to see a championship decided because one team chose one tire over another. And you could make that conversation about engines and power units and gearboxes, but I just don't want tires to be a part of that equation. Like, tires to me are this one underlying principle of parity. Everyone has the same tires. They're provided by the same manufacturer with the same specification. It provides a degree of parity. And we keep talking, like, F1 is all about parity. That's what the 22 regs are about. That's what the 2016 power unit changes are about. If you kind of throw in this new spice of a second tire provider, that whole concept of parity goes out the window. Like, I'm not for that at all. And just one more comment too. I'm sorry, I'm really worked up on the subject tonight, is Max may say that they and Aston Martin gave Pirelli data. We don't know what data they gave them. Was it the data before the race, or was it data during the race? Because I'm pretty convinced neither Aston Martin nor Red Bull fed them the data of the tire temperature or tire pressure during the race. That's the data they need. So then again, the other question is, well, maybe the FIA and Liberty should just, and Pirelli should have real-time access to the tire pressure of all the tires during a race. The teams have that data. Maybe they just need to feed it. So we'll see.
Yeah, that's a great point, because they probably don't, because, you know, back during the race there, after Max had his accident, right, they were immediately on the radio to the race director from the Red Bull pit wall, saying that, hey, we had no indication that this was going to happen. All our data was,
totally.
Was indicating that these tires were fine, you know, the tire temperatures were fine, and this just happened and caught us completely unawares. Anyways, we're going to talk a little bit more about that in after the break, so just hang on, and we'll be back in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, well, welcome back to the show. Hey, Mark, we've been talking for the past 15 minutes or so about Tiregate. So guess what we're going to do for another, well, maybe
Broadcast.
Not another 15 minutes.
Oh, no, I'm getting ahead of myself.
You're getting ahead of yourself. We will talk about Valtteri Bottas.
Oh, come on.
But this is also a bit of a teaser because we're going to talk about this team a little bit later on because they were in the news for all the right reasons this week. But anyways, Alpine Executive Director Marcin Budkowski says it would be quite worrying, those are his words, if teams are playing with tricks, as he calls it, with tire pressures after this whole saga with the tires, the technical directives and everything like that. Anyways, Budkowski had to say, quote, certainly it was important to get to the bottom of it because it is a safety critical matter. The reaction of increasing the rear pressures and the conclusion seem to indicate it's the failure of the tire. The reaction of the FIA is actually not a significant change in the operating procedures. It's a lot more clarity and a lot more tightening of the operational procedures. Whether that suggests that some people were taking some freedoms with the operational procedures, that's a step I won't make because I don't know. But if that's the case, it's quite worrying because that's a safety critical matter. In general, there are tighter procedures and checks that have been imposed. It's not fundamentally different from what was in place. So obviously we welcome the fact that it's going to be checked thoroughly because that's something you don't want to play with, end quote. Yeah, 100%. I mean, it goes back to what we were saying just now, is the fact that it is a safety issue. And that's, that's always has to be the number one concern, is the health and safety of all the drivers. But, you know, it's funny, like, you mentioned it a couple of times there. And just this awful, well, maybe not awful, but this really tough paradox that they have to make these tires that are that are reliable, do the job, have the grip, but are supposed to degrade and be fundamentally useless after 20 laps, 30 laps, 40 laps, whatever it is, based on the compound that they have. I mean, we can go throw a set of tires on our car and drive for 25, 50,000 miles or whatever it is, and you're not going to notice a big difference, at least initially. I mean, if you're down to the wear bars or your tires are completely completely bald or they've been patched a million times because you've had a bunch of punctures and flat tires, that's a bit of a different story. But it is interesting. I mean, it would seem this is a real kind of like niche, really kind of like going down the rabbit hole in this subject, but at the same time, it is really, really interesting. And I just can't get over the fact that if you go and look through the F1 news this week, it's basically tires, 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 tires. And I guess it kind of goes back to the question we had in the mailbag. It was either on Monday or last week. Just the one listener that was asking, well, how often are they trying to push the rules? And I think your answer was they're trying to push and bend the rules all the time. And, you know, based on what we saw in Azerbaijan a couple of weeks ago, this might be an area that even though the teams have denied it, but like you said, there is that anecdote from Sergio Perez and what they were doing at Racing Point last year and before, is perhaps that some of them have been playing around with some of the tire pressures. So it just kind of comes back to that conversation we had a couple of days ago. Doesn't matter what it is, flexi wings, suspensions, engines, tires, if they think that they can get away with finding some sort of advantage somewhere, they're going to try it. In this case, if that was the case, obviously was a spectacular failure in more ways than one because, you know, they might have been caught maybe not red-handed and maybe not as obvious as Ferrari were with the engine contraventions allegedly a couple of years ago. But still, it's that old adage, right? Where there's smoke, there's usually fire.
Yeah. I've got nothing to add. I think
nothing to add.
I think I've said enough about tires. Other than the fact that obviously we'll expect to see a little bit more enforcement. I think one of the big ones is they're going to be a little bit more strict around pre-race tire pressure check protocols. They're going to check tire pressures, I believe, post-race or after the cars have been run or after the tires have been taken off the cars. And then I think they're also going to use heat guns to measure the temperature of the tires to make sure that the warming blankets aren't being used excessively. And I don't know how you determine that, because I don't think there's anything in the sporting regulations about how long a tire blanket can or can't be on a tire, but I'm sure they'll figure it out. But it looks like they're going to take some steps to ensure the structural integrity of these tires to ensure safety during a race.
Well, I guess there's a good market in used temperature guns now that COVID seems to be winding down, you know, those temperature thermometers that you can do and zap people in the face with. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of secondhand ones that, you know, you could buy to check out the temperatures of some Formula One tires. So, yeah, there you go. Anyways, we talked about it. You hinted at it already. I know you're dying to talk about Valtteri Bottas, which, you know, we shouldn't joke about Valtteri. I mean, he's done an absolute outstanding job at Mercedes over the past several years. He said that he's not letting his future with Mercedes become a distraction. And, well, unfortunately, it has become a distraction for everybody else. I mean, if he's able to block it out and focus and get down and do what he needs to do in the car, at the track, you know, props to him, respect to him. But, I mean, there have been so many discussions that we've had about some of these drivers basically since before the season started. And it's just not going to go away anytime soon. We were talking about George Russell the other night, just how he said he wanted to have some certainty about his future in Formula One going into 2022 and all that. And, you know, when it comes to Mercedes, I think they're the only person that has any leverage, that has any bargaining position and any pedestal to stand on is Lewis Hamilton. And anybody else is just, you're going to get what you're going to get. It doesn't matter if you're Valtteri Bottas. It doesn't matter if you're George Russell. I mean, if you're Lewis Hamilton, yeah, there's obviously going to be some back and forth. Or, I mean, if you know, it was some sort of shocker, if it was, say, you know, they were trying to do a deal with Max Verstappen, you know, you could see that. Like, your top tier couple of drivers, obviously, they're going to have a pretty strong bargaining position. But, you know, unfortunately for Valtteri and George, I was going to say Max, but that obviously isn't the case. They're just going to have to wait it out. They'll be ready to talk to these guys when they're ready.
I have nothing to add because I'm so tired of the Valtteri Bottas discussion. I feel like we put this on, so I've got to be careful because I say I won't talk about it and then I'll talk about it for 20 minutes. But what I do want to talk about is, and I'm going to go a little bit off script here, but only because it's pseudo.
No, you can't do that.
That's not about
okay,
contract.
You
said I'm not allowed to talk about Trump or Justin Trudeau, and I mostly don't. But I'm allowed to talk.
Okay. Go off script.
Okay. So my point is the Valtteri Bottas situation. I think it'll be exciting to talk about that more when we know more. But what I did want to add, only because I was looking at a picture of Valtteri Bottas a couple minutes ago, is how great the Black Mercedes official t-shirt merch are this year. There's a photo of Bottas and he's wearing that shirt that has that collar, the neck collar, and it's ringed with a ring of white and a ring of red, and then it says Tommy on it. Looks fantastic. Totally unrelated, but I think it looks really good. And I would add as well that one of the most common questions that we seem to get is about the price of F1 merch. And we talked about this last week. Why is it so expensive? It can be expensive because they sell it. Now, somebody else had made a great point, and I totally, totally apologize for not remembering who it was, but somebody had made a comment that maybe to help break through in the US, the US or Formula One could pair up with Fanatics, the Fanatics website that seems to do merch for all of the major sports leagues, like pump the US full of cheap or more accessible F1 merch just to get it out there, because none of it's out there anyway. So it's like kind of like an untapped market. And I thought that was actually a really wise idea. But anyways, back to the script. Sorry about that.
Well, I'm going to stay off script for a moment because I'm curious to how much that t-shirt would retail for. Do you have, hit me with a number.
Yeah, so let me look it up right now. But what would your guess be?
I'm going to say, do you want dollars or euros or pounds? I'm going to go with, I'm going to say $75.
You know what's,
that's what I'm going with.
We're so bad on this show. I realized this the other day. Like, we interchangeably use like US dollars, Canadian dollars, euros. Like, oh, this team costs a billion what, Hamilton? Like, what does it actually cost? Like, I don't know, a billion.
Well, the majority of our listeners are in the United States. So let's just say that the default currency, unless, we preface it with Canadian dollars or Australian dollars or something like that, is US dollars. That should just be a given.
Yeah, I think that's fair, especially since Liberty is technically a US company. So they typically report revenue and earnings and things like that. So it is $60 US, which would be 80 Canadian.
Yeah, that seems about right. That isn't actually quite as horrible as I was expecting. I mean, it's still, you know, frightfully expensive for just a t-shirt, yeah. But in Formula One terms, that's actually almost not that bad.
It's not terrible, right? And like I've said before, because I have some experience buying some Mercedes merch, the quality is super, super good. But again, we're not being paid by Mercedes, so we should probably move on to the next topic.
The next topic, and he's going to be so upset if he actually listens to this show, is going to be Esteban Ocon, who signed a new deal with Alpine to stay with them until 2024. If he listens to this, he's like, guys, I got in like wedged in after tires, after Mazepin,
t-shirt.
After you guys surfed the web to find out a t-shirt price.
Yep. He's quality like, come on.
But anyways, quality research, quality podcast here. Anyways, yeah, I think this is great news, Esteban. I think that he really deserves this contract. And the term of 3 years is something not to turn your nose up at, because Formula One, as we've talked about before, tend not to hand out super uber long-term contracts. So I think the fact that they've committed to him for the next three seasons is significant. And I think for Esteban, I think this is wonderful because it gives him security. And it's a bit of a reward or a bit of payback for some of the bumps that he went through early in his career, specifically when he sat out that one season when he was reserve driver to Mercedes, didn't get the opportunity to get back into a race seat until 2020. And I think that if you're Esteban Ocon, I think you got to be really happy. You got to be excited about the future. And now you can just get down to racing, and then also focusing on helping this team to try develop and build and improve this car.
I completely agree. I'm very, very, very happy for Esteban Ocon. And I think we said that on our Twitter feed. And I think you make a really great point as well, that we're used to with North American sports to seeing longer guaranteed contracts. The NBA, you'll see those 4 or 5 year deals. Major League Baseball, you see these crazy 10-year deals. You see these super long terms in the NHL. With the exception of the NFL, like all of the North American sports contracts are guaranteed and they're these long terms. But in F1, it's normal to see a 1 or 2 year deal. I think what excites me most about this one, though, is if Alpine is committing to Ocon for 3 years, to me, that infers that maybe their commitment to the sport is greater than maybe they've let on. Because in the back of my head, I've always been concerned about Renault and Alpine's commitment to Formula One, and I'd hate to lose them. They're spending all this money to produce a power unit, but they're not selling it to any other teams. They don't have any customer teams. Like, this is an expensive operations. They scored a couple of podiums last year, but they've really struggled since re-entering the sport after taking over Lotus back in 2015. Like, I feel good, one, for Ocon, but two, because I feel good that this speaks to the commitment potentially that Alpine has to the sport. And just to recap as well, and I think we've done this a couple of times, this is a kid came into Formula One in the back half of 2016, racing for Manor. You have to look up Manor because you probably won't have heard of them. Had a phenomenal 2017. Didn't score any podiums with Force India, but had a phenomenal 2017. Scored points in all but two races. 2018 was a little bit more choppy, but that was also the year that Force India went through administration and weren't developing the car. And then, of course, he sat out 2019, and he came back 2020 strong. Had some retirement reliability issues, but this year he has 4 points finishes in 6 races. Hasn't been close to a podium, but I think that's more a reflection of the car than it is him. Yeah. And I think it's also good in a way that it looks like the relationship between he and Fernando Alonso is good. And I wasn't sure it was going to be, but I feel like Fernando, now being in his 40s, recognizes that maybe my value here isn't the expectation that I'm going to score a podium or win races or win a championship, but maybe I'm just here to deliver value to the team and provide valuable feedback and help them develop the car through that feedback. And I think the other thing that's really important here too is that Alpine effectively functions as the French national team, being Renault owned, and to have a French driver for marketing purposes is just, it's really good for that team.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was very interesting. I don't know if we really talked about it at the time when they announced the rebrand over the winter from Renault to Alpine, but they were kind of resurrecting this historic brand, right? This historic name. And it was one of those kind of like, I don't want to say it was like a throwaway quote, but I think it was one of those quotes that it kind of fell between the cracks a little bit, but at the same time, it kind of burrowed its way into the back of my mind, and it's kind of stuck there for, you know, quite some time. And I can't remember who made it, if it might have been a Beetleboel at the time prior to his sudden departure from the team in the offseason, but it was something to to the effect of that by rebranding from Renault to Alpine was basically going to be a much more longer term commitment in Formula One. And I thought to myself, I don't remember the exact way it was it was spoken, but I thought at the time that it was fascinating, because I thought, why would just a simple rebrand change the commitment to the sports? And it kind of made me wonder what was going on behind the scenes at the board level, where all the decisions get made, and why they made they decided to actually do this. But you know, if that's the case, I think it's great, because I'll admit I think that I'm lukewarm on the Renault Alpine revival, if you want to call it that, ever since 2014, 2015. I mean, they've really underwhelmed and they've disappointed. I think that the power unit obviously isn't quite as beefy as, say, some of the other ones that are out there, but I think it's slightly improved. But I mean, I would have expected that the first year or two after taking over that Lotus project, of course, the year one was just going to be a rebadged Lotus with Renault livery on it. And I would have thought that it would have taken them a couple of years. And they did improve, but it wasn't like a real sharp climb in results and performance and everything like that. It was much more gradual, and then it kind of flattened out. And then if anything, it regressed a little bit. And that's why it was so disappointing. But you know, they really do have, I think that Ocon is maybe a bit of an underrated driver. I mean, we definitely saw some flashes of how good he can be when he was at Racing Point. Of course, there is that incident that he had with Max Verstappen in Brazil a couple of years ago when he was trying to unlap himself, which is probably maybe not his his best shining moment in Formula One. But I mean, he's still young, he's fast, and I think that he's got a lot of room to grow still. And it is interesting too, if you look at the driver standings right now, Fernando and Esteban are 11th and 12th in the Drivers Championship at the moment, 13 and 12 points respectively. But I think that it is interesting, that dynamic that you pointed out between himself and Fernando is very different than some of the relationships that Fernando's had with some of his teammates in the past. And I'll let you respond to that in a moment after we take a break here. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right, well, welcome back to the show. We're talking now about Alpine. We're talking about Esteban Ocon and his brand new 3-year deal. Before the break, I was just talking, Mark, about how the relationship that you pointed out a little bit earlier between Fernando and Alonso and Esteban Ocon seems to be pretty good. And to me, you know, immediately my reaction when you said that to me, or when you said that just now, was I was thinking that this is certainly not the kind of relationship that Fernando has been or had with his teammates in the past. They either just didn't exist or they were openly hostile. So to hear that there is this sort of connectivity, there is this a bit of teamwork going on. The fact that that he seems to be I don't know how engaged, but certainly seems to be in there to help develop the car, and sharing data and things with Esteban seems very, very un-Fernando like. And I think that you really made a very, very good point
there. I think it's a good fit for Fernando. I don't think he left F1 on his terms after that whole McLaren situation. But I think the reality is, given how toxic that situation was, I think a lot of teams were very nervous about potentially signing Fernando. One, because of his age. He was an older driver. But two, because this guy has a rap, right? And that rap is that he can be very vocal. He can be a lot abrasive. There's a lot of friction with teammates, especially the other driver. And you make a great point too. Like if you flash back to 2007, that one bizarre year that he had with McLaren, like it was absolute fireworks mm-hmm. between him and Hamilton, and the scandals and the speculation of what happened that season and how Hamilton's almost like guaranteed championship slipped away at the last second. Like there's definitely been a history here. So it's good to see that he's functioning more as a team first driver. And I think this is good for him because potentially he gets to go out on his own terms and he gets to go out on a team that he's had immense success with. And for some of our newer listeners, Fernando Alonso drove with the Renault team for most of the early part of his career. I think he was with them from 2003 until 2006. He won the championship in both 2005 and 2006. In a shock move, he left Renault and went to McLaren for 2007. Then he bounced right back to Renault for a couple of years and there were some additional scandals. But this is the team where he's experienced his most success. And if he can wrap up his career there, then fantastic. And if he can help develop the car and provide feedback and help develop Ocon in some meaningful way, that's great too.
Yeah, absolutely. And Michelle Gonzalez in the live chat, she made a really good point about Esteban, saying that, quote, "I think Ocon is another one like Lewis. He didn't come from money and really had to struggle to afford karting and the Under Series." Great point.
Yeah, great point.
Yeah. Okay. Sticking with Alpine now, they've admitted that they're still looking for answers to why their car is really good in qualifying, but really not up to scratch when it comes to the races itself. And that must be so frustrating if you're a driver, knowing that and they've had some pretty decent qualifying sessions this year. I mean, absolutely, but it must be so frustrating for everybody involved in that team that there's a big disconnect somewhere in the performance in this car from Saturday to Sunday, and I don't know. I mean, if you're Esteban or Fernando, you just must be ready to bang your head up against the wall, knowing that you can qualify well, but you're just not going to have the car underneath you on Sunday. And that is just I find this really kind of weird, especially that this isn't a brand new car. I mean, this is basically the same car that they've had for the past 2.5 years with some slight modifications and different bits that have been added to them for the slight modifications that we've seen since 2019. But still, I find this, yeah, I just find it such a bizarre statement from CEO Marcin Budkowski. And this is what he has to say. Quote, "We have to work hard to understand our race pace deficit, and it's something we're actively investigating. It is clear that the car is capable of good performances in qualifying, but on some circuits, we just can't seem to replicate that good pace in race conditions, and that's something we need to get on top of to score bigger points in the championship. We hope that our findings so far will help us achieving a good result in France on a full-time circuit more typical than what we see in Formula One," end quote. So it seems like themselves are completely at a loss, but I guess also at the same time, Mercedes have, we talked about it, that the fact that they don't have the DAS on the car this year is probably affecting the performance on the car, but also that they've come out and said that, they're not 100% sure that why this car isn't as good as it has been over the past couple of years. So Alpine, not the only ones out there struggling.
I think the bizarre thing is exactly what you stated, which is they have great pace in qualifying, and then that pace just seems to fade away during the course of the race. I don't know if you remember, but back in April, Marcin Budkowski, who I think functions as the executive director of the Alpine Racing Team, he made a comment that kind of reflected what I think a lot of people suspected, which is Alpine didn't have a great winter in terms of car development. And a big chunk of that was traced back to the fact that they openly admitted that they had some major issues with their wind tunnel during the offseason. And they had a lot of downtime with the wind tunnel, which meant they weren't able to rapidly develop the aero as quickly as they want to. Because if the wind tunnel's down, you can't put that model in that wind tunnel to determine whether your aero upgrades are working and whether they need tweaking. And of course, you can rely pretty heavily on computational fluid dynamics for some of it, but I think teams still fundamentally rely on the wind tunnel. So they openly admitted back in April that they were kind of on the back foot when the season began. They had some pretty good upgrades by the time we got to the first race of the season, but what is really bizarre right now is just their qualifying pace, to your point, relative to the performance that they have in the course of the race. The fact that they can sustain a really strong pace for 4 or 5 or 6 laps during qualifying, but can't enable that to translate into the race. And like, is it that they're running a really crazy engine mode in qualifying that's really stressing the capabilities of the engine, which isn't sustainable during the course of a 40 or 50 lap? Is it that they're doing something funky with the tire pressures? I don't know. And I can't put my finger on it. And I spent a little bit of time trying to talk to some folks around the sport to get a sense. And it seems to be a mystery for everyone ultimately.
Yeah, it's very, very bizarre. Hey, Mark, what do you want to do now? Shall we do you have any tweets or emails or anything? I've got an email.
Yeah, we've got questions. But yeah, let's jump to an email.
Okay, we got one email here. We'll talk about this one, and then we'll go into the break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about the French Grand Prix. Anyways, this one is interesting. This is from Aaron Lewis, and he says, hey, guys, first off, love the pod. I think you guys do a fantastic job, and you guys make F1 and the history of F1 and the technical side really easy to understand. And Aaron, he's a Gen DTS. Anyways, he goes on to say, as someone living in the United States, I feel the USA is missing out on this worldwide sport. I know Haas is an American team, but in a weird way, it doesn't feel that way. And that could just be me. No, Aaron, it is not you. I totally agree with that statement. He goes on to say, but my other question is, do you think with the addition of another US Grand Prix in 2022, will that make for more interest with for another US F1 team or even a US power unit? I've always thought that Ford would make a great PU for F1. I know cost would be the biggest issue, but I think Ford with their EcoBoost engines would be perfect. Would be a perfect starting point for the world of F1 and their turbo hybrid engines. Ford, I feel, have done an amazing job of getting power out of a turbo V6 engine instead of V8. The Ford Raptor, for example. I know Ford already has a history with F1 before with Cosworth and Jaguar. But do you think that Ford would make a great fit for an engine provider for F1? And do you think that you can see a team in F1 that would be a US-based team? Sorry about the long question, but thank you for reading it and keep up the great work, guys. Well, awesome. Thanks. That's a great question, Aaron. And yeah, Ford, I think if it would come to an engine manufacturer, an American one at that point, would have to be Ford. Obviously, with the historical tie-in to Formula One, I just couldn't see, say, Chevrolet or somebody else like that getting involved, at least not at this point. And I think that there still are a lot of questions. You know, obviously, cost is a huge one. I mean, it is massively, massively expensive. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, that's why Honda, I think, well, I mean, they didn't come in originally. They were only a year or two behind everyone else when they came back in 2015, but they started their development so much later than Ferrari, then Renault, then Mercedes, and they were really, really far behind on it. And I guess the big question comes down to, you know, is there will at the highest levels of Ford to want to get back into Formula One? I mean, I think that there would be a fit there, but I think ultimately that's where it comes down to. And I think just also for the demand or the interest to have another American-based team, and I totally get why Aaron is saying that Haas, even though it's an American team, it doesn't feel like an American team, even though, you know, they got the American flag on the side of the car and all that. And where are they based? It's somewhere, was it Greensboro, yeah, North Carolina? Yeah, I mean, they certainly don't feel like an American team. And so that is just not, you know, Aaron just, you know, feeling that on his own. I completely agree with that comment. But I think ultimately, if we were to see another American team in Formula One, I think it would have to do, it would have to make sense for somebody to make that step. I think that the popularity and the support, I think people that absolutely have to be rabid to do it. And then somebody with a lot of money sitting somewhere would have to be thinking, hey, this is something that we have to get in on. We need to do this. You know, the American sporting public is crying out for this other team. And certainly having two races at Austin and Miami next year, that's certainly going to raise the profile. And certainly, I mean, there is room for massive growth in the United States. It's just, where do they get to and how excited do people get about it? And I think that ultimately will drive a lot of these other things, seeing other manufacturers coming in, other teams, drivers, whatever, sponsorship. I think all those things will ultimately sort of flow from where the popularity goes. And we're seeing it ourselves that, as I said, that the audience for this show, even though we've never tried to target any audience anywhere in the world, organically, the listenership, the viewership on this show is 60%, almost 60% based in the United States, which, you know, says something right there.
Yes, I love Texas and California and every other state that our American listeners are based in. Andre in Southern Florida, thank you for listening and asking questions while we're doing the show. Just one point on that Ford piece. I think the challenge would be this. If Ford wanted to get into open wheel racing, why isn't it competing in Indy today? Why is it allowing Chevy to be the only American power unit producer? And they have been in Formula One in modern history, right? So I don't think a lot of our kind of newer listeners would know this, but Ford had a factory team in 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004. They branded it using the Jaguar branding, but it was a factory Ford team, although at least early on they were using Cosworth engines. So Ford put the full might of the organization behind a Formula One team. And really, you could write books about how poorly managed that was. If you're interested, the Jaguar team eventually became Red Bull. So Red Bull's roots are actually in that Ford team, but Ford's done it before. And I think they hemorrhaged money. They weren't enjoying it. I don't think it was providing any significant value to the brand. But then again, maybe that's simply because they were fronting the Jaguar brand, which has limited appeal. And it has limited appeal now, even though they're developing a really exceptional product. The JLR group under the Tata ownership is doing fantastic work. But back in the early 2000s, the Jaguar product was total garbage. It had limited appeal. It had terrible reputation. The cost was super high. And ultimately, that was the brand they decided to front. So maybe it would have been more successful if they'd marketed a more broadly appealed brand. And I think one of the things that Americans forget or don't know is that Ford themselves is a massive brand in the UK. Like the Ford Focus and the Ford Fiesta and those compact cars, they eat up a huge chunk of market share. And I think sometimes we really think about Ford as being a North American domestic manufacturer that maybe doesn't have that imprint in other countries. Not the case. Now, I would love to see it. Whether we're going to see it, I don't know or not. But it kind of leads into our next question, actually.
Well, before we get into the next question, we do have to take a break. But before we do that, I just wanted to add on to that. I mean, Jaguar, before that, were they not Stewart
F1? Yeah, they were.
Which was put together by Paul Stewart and Jackie Stewart. Jackie, three-time world champion, who raced for Tyrrell back in the 60s and 70s. And when he won his world championships and had his success in Formula One, were powered by Ford Cosworth, and he maintained those relationships with the Ford Motor Company, pardon me, over the years, over the decades. And when they came back into, or when they took Stewart Racing, because they were racing in other formulas, junior formulas, when they started a Formula One team, they had those Ford engines, and they rebranded to Jaguar. And then, as you say, you kind of laid it out how badly that that was all run, which was kind of sad. Anyways, let's take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll preview the French Grand Prix. You've got some
questions
to read out. What's that? Go for it.
Have we got time? We got to take a break.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll do your question. Okay, so we'll be right back. Don't go away, guys. We're going to be back in no time at all. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. It's question time for the time being. Mark, you're all eager to go. What do you got for
us? So this question I actually got from three different people, and I've received it so many times now. I thought we should probably address this one on the air. So the first question is this: if F1 can have 26 cars on the grid or 13 teams, why aren't there 13 teams? And then the second question that we always get is, does a team have to have two cars on the grid? And I think that the answer is this. It's not that F1 doesn't want 13 teams. It ultimately just comes down to the economics of standing up a team. And what we saw with Haas is that the other teams weren't willing to share in prize money for a first-year team. The other thing is that the way that the current Concorde agreement is structured is that only teams in the top 10 can share in prize money. So if I'm going to stand up a Formula One team, it's going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars. It's going to be an incredibly expensive affair. There's no guarantee that I'm ever going to see an ROI on that investment. And then if I don't perform well, I may not see any money anyways from a championship points perspective. The other point too is from a driver perspective. So the other question, and this one actually came specifically from Broncos Elite. This one came specifically from Broncos Elite. But the question is, could a team run an operation with a single driver? So I wasn't 100% certain. So I went to the sporting regulations to kind of get a better sense of this. And specifically, the language is really, hey, each competitor may have no more than two cars available for use at any time during an event. But there doesn't seem to be any real clear guidelines about whether a team could run a single car operation. The reality is, though, that it would make no financial sense to do it. If you're standing up an organization to build one car and you're allowed two, you build two because it doubles the chances that you're going to be able to score constructors points and cash in on the prize money at the end of the season. If you build an organization to race one car, which is the kind of thing we see in Indy, you're at an immediate financial disadvantage because you have half the capacity to score points and score podiums that you would as any other team on the grid. So even if you could, you would never do it just because it doesn't make any fiscal sense. Anything I missed? Anything you want to add?
No, I think that you've touched on it, perfectly right there. I mean, like we've said before, these cars, I mean, they are incredibly unique. I mean, all the parts that are designed and built, it's frightfully expensive. I mean, it's going to be expensive regardless, if you're building one or two. But I would imagine if you're already spending the money to buy or build one car, I can't imagine totally. That it's going to be the same amount to build the second car. But it just from a financial point of view, it just would seem so cost prohibitive. And also, kind of an interesting twist on this is that we're not really all that far removed in recent times that they were actually putting out there, even just a couple of years ago, perhaps even allowing the teams to run totally. Three cars. Whereas, if you're Ferrari or Mercedes and you've got tons of money, that you could probably do that. Where some of the smaller teams, think like your Haas's, your Williams and teams like that, where we're struggling just to get two teams on the grid and race with those. So please don't go to make us rate as a third car because we just couldn't do it. Cool. All right, you got another one for us? It looks like it. Or no?
Nope, I'm good to go.
Oh, you're good to go. Okay, well, let's talk about the race this weekend. First of all, I just wanted to remind everybody, let me just grab everything. So before we get into it, a quick reminder on the driver standings. Got Max on top in first, 105 points. Lewis second with 101. Sergio Perez, 69. Lando Norris, fourth in the driver's championship with 66. Charles Leclerc rounded out the top five with 52. On the constructors' side, it's obviously very close in the drivers, but was interesting after Baku was, despite all the drama and everything like that, Red Bull was actually able to open up that gap at the top of the constructors' championship. So Red Bull, 174 points compared to Mercedes in second with 148. Ferrari, third with 94. McLaren, 92. And then AlphaTauri rounding out the top five with 39 points. And before we talk about the race, I just wanted to read some stats off for Sequoia Paul Ricard. So this is a track that is 5.8 kilometers long. We're going to have 53 laps this weekend, which is just over 309.6 kilometers. Lap record was set in 2019 by Sebastian Vettel, and the Ferrari is a 132.740. So Pirelli, they are bringing their mid-range of their compounds. They're bringing the C2 hards, the C3 mediums, and the C4 softs. And I know we were talking about it a couple of days ago here, that just about the track itself, but since and just the sort of the racing that we're going to see, but since we've returned to Paul Ricard, because after, remember, we did not have a French Grand Prix, which I still find mind-boggling, from the 2009 to 2017.
God, it's crazy.
Yeah, for that long, almost a decade that there was not a French Grand Prix. So Lewis has won the race there the past 2 years. Well, not the past 2 years, 2018, 19. Obviously, French Grand Prix was not held last year because of the pandemic. And then previously to that, I mean, the race was run by Felipe Massa in 2008, driving Ferrari, 2007, Kimi Raikkonen driving Ferrari, 2006, Michael Schumacher driving a Ferrari. And it's back in France, and I do have some mixed feelings about it. I think that this is a circuit that is very interesting. I mean, you got the Mistral straight at the back. It's about a mile, just over a mile long, just 1.8 kilometers long, I believe it is. Excuse me, but they have the chicane about not quite halfway down, just because the speeds would be too high. It is an interesting track. It's not very wide. It's a very compact layout. I mean, so typically you see circuits that are a big loop out on a complex. This one is very narrow, very very tight. It winds back in on itself, and despite some of the tight corners and stuff like that, it doesn't actually lend for a lot of overtaking. And despite a lot of the drama that we can see in the opening laps, because you go from start finish into a very slow left right combo, and then you get into sort of a hairpin at the sort of about a third of the way around the lap, there aren't really too many opportunities for overtaking, and they haven't really been the most exciting races the past couple of years. Hoping it changes this weekend, but you know.
I remember back in 2019, Nico Hülkenberg had made some comments about this being the worst type of track because it brings out the worst in F1. It's a bunch of super long, medium speed corners, which are the hardest for enabling cars to follow each other, the hardest for overtaking. It's also just, and this is more just cosmetic, but if you look at the track, it looks weird. And again, cosmetics shouldn't matter if there's great racing, but it's basically a gigantic, like 100-acre slab of pavement. And then what they do is they paint the whole thing blue, but they run a racetrack through it. So what that means is that there's a ton of margin for error, because if you go off the track, if you exceed the track limits, if you spin, you just spin on the tarmac and you can drive back on. There's places where there are hundreds of meters of tarmac between the track and a fence. So there's no risk of a crash. There's no grass. There's no sand trap. It's ultra low risk. And presumably that would incent the drivers to push a little bit harder. But again, because the track is so challenging from a construction perspective to overtake, it doesn't matter necessarily if they do. But I would be a much bigger fan of this track if they tore up all that tarmac, put down grass, and put down sand traps, because at least it introduces a risk of some more unpredictable racing. The other thing that's really interesting about this track, though, is it's only a two-hour drive from Monaco, but it's, relatively speaking, based on French population bases, it's 4.5 hours from Toulouse. It's 7.5 hour drive from Paris. It's really peculiar that we finally have a French Grand Prix, but we nestle it right in the southern coast next to Monaco, and we don't basically put it somewhere where we can tap into the bigger metropolitan areas of France. It's an interesting place to put it. I remember the first year we went back, which I think you said was 17. Was 17 the first year we went back, or 18?
2018.
Yeah, 2018. There was tons of questions about the logistics of getting people in and getting people out, but the crowd seemed to have been okay. But ultimately, it just seems like a weird place to put it, that you would go basically head to head with Monaco, because Monaco was what, a month ago, and now we're going to host a race in the same region. I just feel like if I was a French race organizer, I'd want to put a track closer to Paris. But ultimately, if they sell out, I guess it doesn't matter. I think for me, it's the look of the track. It's the feel of the track. It's not built for modern cars. Hopefully it's unpredictable. Hopefully it maybe rains this weekend, but I'm not super, super excited. But again, one of our listeners made a really great point, which was, forget what happens on the track. Consider what's happening in the championship standings right now. That should itself lend a sense of intrigue to the proceedings. And that listener was 100% right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, it's going to be interesting to see what happens on the track. I mean, maybe this one, it's not so much like we see in Monaco, where, you know, your qualifying is, you know, so critical, because, you know, you're not going to have an opportunity to make up places. I mean, this isn't a track that's as drastic when it comes to track position and qualifying as Monaco and maybe Hungary, or a track, you know, a road track like that. But I mean, still, it is a little bit frustrating to watch. I mean, when I think about the past couple of you know, races that we've had there in 18 and 19, I mean, the one race that really stands out is in 2019, which was Lando's rookie year, when he had like that hydraulic issue right at the very end, and he was able to hang on and still finish somewhere in the points right at the back there. I can't remember exactly what it was. I mean, he was running pretty good, and then he sort of like sort of filtered down through the race order there, but still managed to score some points. But, you know, it is what it is, right? And he didn't. I'm just checking. He actually finished 11th, which that is the standings. Anyways, I'm not going to go through it too much right now. But if the one thing sort of really stands out in my mind is somebody that sort of struggled to bring the car home, that was, experiencing some mechanical issues, kind of tells you everything you really need to know about the action on the track. But ultimately, I mean, all the eyes will be on Lewis. All the eyes will be on Max this weekend. I mean, just going back to the drama that we had a couple of weeks ago in Baku, I mean, it was just the way that the pendulum swung back and forth. I mean, Max has that tire issue. He crashes. His race is over. It just sort of seems that all of a sudden it's set up 100%. You know, it's going to fall in Lewis's laps, that he's going to be able to, almost win that race. I don't want to say undeservedly, because, you know, things just don't happen. But I mean, the good fortune was just incredible. And then that dramatic restart, I mean, when it came down to it, had you asked me even 10 laps into that race, do you foresee a scenario that neither Max Verstappen nor Lewis Hamilton would score a single world championship point in this race, I would have laughed at you. And then I would have mocked you, and then I would have laughed again. But that's completely what happened. And it was just so dramatic. And I think that, you know, both of them, I mean, obviously that gap, that 4-point gap, you remained static from Monaco to Azerbaijan and now to France. But both of them are going to want to make up for what happened a couple of weeks ago. Max obviously had the opportunity to increase his championship lead, and it didn't work out that way. And Lewis was not able to close that small gap and reclaim the lead in the championship. So it's going to be a follow-up from that, and they're going to build on that. And I'm just hoping that what we've seen through the first half dozen races of the year just continues to keep going all season long, and I'm hoping it's going to continue.
I wonder if we look back at the 2021 season, and that moment at Baku is Malaysia from 2016. You know, and again, that
right.
engine failure wasn't his fault, but it happened, and he basically lost all of the points that he would have secured in that race, which would have potentially put him over the top. Yeah, I wonder if we look back, and this was that moment for 2021. And again, so forget the fact that it maybe isn't the most exciting track. What's exciting is we have a championship battle, and that should lend some degree of intrigue. So hopefully at the end of the race, it's less about, hey, Mercedes took a 1-2, they're 150 points up in the championship, but hey, it was a Max-Lewis battle, and ultimately Max won, and it kind of gives them a little bit more space in the like, that should be what we're talking about, and hopefully what we're going to be talking about come Sunday.
Yeah, you know, and to the track is interesting because we haven't really seen a track like this. I mean, Baku has that, obviously, that very long start-finish straightaway. And, you know, then you've got like the city portion of the track, which is a little bit different. It's sort of Monaco-esque. And then you kind of go back and look at some of the different tracks that we've been at this year, like Imola, like Bahrain, and then, you know, Portugal and Spain. So this is a little bit different, you know, to some of the different tracks. So I really don't know at this point whether this is going to favor Mercedes or if this is going to favor Red Bull. It's going to be interesting to see what maybe some of the practice times are closer to qualifying on Saturday. I mean, when we have FP1 coming up here shortly, that's just the initial shakedowns and getting the car set up. It's going to be interesting to see, though, on Saturday when we get to FP3, what some of those times are looking at, and when they're a little bit more in their qualifying trim, and of course in qualifying itself. And I really just hope, like I say, that this battle that we've seen over the past couple of months just keeps going. But like you say, what you thought happened at Baku was one of those Malaysia 2016 moments, because I felt that same thing when Max crashed. I said that to my wife at the time, that this could be that moment that Max looks back at the end of the year. That's where I lost it. And then at the end of the race, we were saying the same thing, that, you know, I mean, there's only 4 points between them. It's not like it's 30 or 40 or 20 or something like that. I mean, the gap is still fairly small, but the point is they left points out on the table. And if they keep going like this, this championship could very well be decided by a very, very slim margin.
Yeah, I completely agree. Completely agree. One other point too, that's unrelated to the race, but may intrigue our listeners. Did you know that our listeners refer to me as the excited one, and to you as the chill one?
Yeah. The chill one. Oh yeah, no. I saw the tweet last night, and I was kind of interested by that. They thought you were the excited one. Like,
I don't think it was a compliment. I guess don't think I was getting a compliment.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess maybe being the chill one is a good thing. Fortunately, nobody said that we were the annoying one. They said, well, you know, nobody said that. So I guess, you know, for the moment, we can both claim to being the annoying one.
Fair,
so
fair.
There you go. All right. That's all I got. I'm giving you a chance to do a MotoGP quarter. Nothing from MotoGP quarter this week.
I'm not prepared. I'm so sorry. I don't think I've disappointed any of our listeners. And I even commented on Twitter that is basically the only real value I bring to the show. And I haven't done one in a month, but I promise I'll have one for Sunday. Which means probably next Thursday.
All right. Next Thursday. There you go. All right, guys. Well, that's great. Thank you for checking in. Thank you for listening to the podcast and for checking out the live stream on YouTube. That's really enjoyed being able to interact with everybody and talk to you guys all the time, especially on the live chat. I think it's great. Anyways, that's it. That's a wrap. On behalf of myself, Chill Mark, and on behalf of Excited Mark, thank you all for listening and watching. Enjoy the race on Sunday, and we'll be back on Sunday night to recap it, and hopefully we'll have an exciting and a good race to talk about. Until then, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you guys again in a couple of days. Bye for now.